Right. Hello, everyone. Hello, that beautiful dachshund. I'll go around and say hello to everyone, starting with Mark and Linda R. Adriana. Is it Adriana or Adriana?
Either way,
how would you say it?
Adriana.
Okay. I guess, right then. Joan. Bob. Paul. Susan. Marv. Joyce. And, oh, I almost Doug. Have
Doug.
Doug. Doug. Joy, you should put it in, write it down on your little. Tyler. Ka? Veda? How should we address you?
Qua.
Qua. Yeah. And that's the your first name. So
that's my first name.
Yeah. Qua. Okay. Shoketsu. Karen. Paula. Drew. Franklin. Betty, Dave, Erica, Yeshetsoki, Sabrina, and Ruth Ann. All right. Okay, so I know there's a couple announcements. First, I am planning to start things back up at our local Zendo. I was being cautious out of respect in part for, you know, the healthcare system and all that, but then I'm hearing all of this about like people going to the theater, people going to sports games, the restaurants are full of people, and I'm like, that's, well, that's kind of dumb for us not to be meeting if all of this stuff is happening. So for those of you who are local, we're going to start off with limited participation, but I don't think the demand's going to be so incredibly high that we'll run into a problem with that. We'll just deal with it if that happens, but I figured the Zendo capacity limited to 12, but like I said, I don't think we're going to run into that very soon. And I do need help from folks to help staff the events. So for every event, I'll be there, but I need at least two other people to either be the greeter at the door or help, you know, open things up and close things down. If you do that, in order to come to the Zendo, you need to be fully vaccinated, and we'll be wearing masks. So if that qualifies and you want to help out at the Zendo, please email me and let me know, because I'm starting to compile a list of volunteers and Joan is going to help us schedule them. And then for those who are on Zoom, in case you don't already know, our Zendo is set up for Zoom participation. So even when we're back, we'll simply be hosting from the Zendo. I will be, a few of us will be sitting in the Zendo instead of on Zoom like this. So everything will continue more or less. Some adaptations as we go, I'm sure. Shoketsu, did you have something?
No.
Oh.
I was just, when you said Joan was scheduling them.
Yes, she just told me today that she was willing to do that. So I was going to write about that.
Oh, okay. I thought you made a mistake.
No, I didn't. So thank I'll you. Talk to you about the handoff of that responsibility. Thank you for Shoketsu's been scheduling our Zoom greeters for all this long time. And I think, do we have a fundraising announcement? Who's up for that this week? It was supposed to be somebody.
When I talked to James at like 7 or at 6:45, he thought it was him.
But he is not here. Well, I guess I'll do it. Anyway, so we had our first, I mean, it wasn't our first fundraiser this year. We did have, an event in the past, but this was our first, kind of annual fundraiser where board members and other volunteers can divide up the membership list, give everybody a call, and ask, and just check in as, what's working for you, what's not. Thank you for your continued support. And also then, is there any, can you increase your giving or make an extra donation? And many, many people have. It's perfectly understandable if people can't, but many, many people have. So we originally set our goal at for $5,000, and then we passed that. So we were like, and we wanted to set a goal that we knew we could meet, so it wouldn't be disappointing. But then we're like, well, let's set a goal of $10,000. I think we can do it, and we have passed that. So this is really great. It's really an indication of the level of support, and for those of you who gave, it is a wonderful thing for also for us to be able to offer everything that we offer. Like, there is ultimately no charge. Mean, we have suggested donations for things, but if anybody ever has an issue and isn't able to pay, or pay needs to pay less or something, we don't even deal with scholarships. We just say, just pay what you can. So that's part of this, generosity on people's part is what allows us to operate that way. So thank you very much. And we are going to be the fundraiser doesn't officially end until the 20th. So if you want to participate, you still can. There's still a link on the front of the website. If you haven't If you're a member and you haven't received a call, don't feel bad. We've probably been trying. And if anybody isn't already a member, you might want to check that out as a way to support the Zen Center if you find that it is helpful to you. Anything else anybody can think of to announce, or anybody have any questions? One thing, additional thing that I wanted to mention is that many Zen centers have a traditional retreat in early December called Rohatsu. And what I typically do is encourage people to come with me out to participate in the retreat at Great Bow Zen Monastery. This is, I don't lead a Rohatsu. I did last year because we were all stuck at home, but I will lead other retreats, but at Rohatsu I just go and I try to sit deeply and let go along with everybody else. But if you want to, usually there ends up being a small group of us that go from Bright Way out there, and it's kind of sweet to have Sangha members. And the good news is that they are going to be open for in-person participation. You need to be vaccinated and get a test within like 3 days, or get the results within 3 days of going. So if you're willing to jump through those hoops, the joy and challenge of an in-person session is available. And for those of you who are all over the place, that may starting to be the case for places that are closer to you as well. So I always encourage sessions. All right. With that, any questions about that? All right. So tonight we continue with our Nine Fields of Zen Practice class series, and this is class six. And we're on the fifth of the fields. No, the fourth of the fields. Wait a second. It's not adding up. So it's only class five. Anyway, Past classes can be found. Oh yeah, we did an extra one. We did an extra one on cultivating insight. Okay, so I'm right. This is the fourth field, but it's the sixth class. If you want to listen to previous classes, they're on the website. Either you can watch a Zoom video or listen to the audio. And the nine fields are, let's see, to pull that up. There's a link to them on the Zen Studies podcast website, and I think also if you go to the Brightway Zen website, they on the Tuesday study, it has a link to the Zen Studies podcast website. Hi, James. I already made the announcement for you.
Oh, I had all this really great stuff. I was going to play a fanfare on the trumpet. No, I'm joking. I wasn't able to do that.
So,
Okay.
if you want to pop off now, that's fine, but
Okay.
your duty has been covered.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I do need to pop off because I've got my daughter in the other room getting ready for bed, so I better go
All
take care
right.
of that. So, okay. Well, thanks. Good to see everybody.
All right. So the nine fields are basically, I designed them to describe all the different forms that Zen practice can take and try to stimulate the imagination so that you can see all the different ways that Zen practice can permeate your life. So we've already covered Zazen. Pretty obvious that that should be a field of Zen practice. Dharma study and cultivating insight. Tonight we're going to talk about the precepts, and then subsequent classes we'll talk about opening the heart, connecting with the ineffable, Nyoho or mindfulness, karma work, and bodhisattva activity. So, in terms of the precepts, we talk about the precepts a lot here at Brightway. We study them every year. That is kind of a, that's just a lineage thing. That is something that Dharma Rain does, and every Dharma cloud lineage that came from there, that's what we do. We study the precepts every year, like it or not. So we usually do about a 10-week series on the precepts in the spring. And I'm going to tell you what the precepts are, just in case you don't know. There are moral guidelines in Zen. But I think there was also a Dharma talk on the precepts by Ryushin just a couple weeks ago on a Sunday. So I'll keep this overview as brief as I can, and then I want to, we'll talk about the precepts as a field, as one of the nine fields, as a field of Zen practice. So if you want to know more about the precepts, there are recordings of all the classes that we have done on the Brightway Zen website. So under resources, audio, or no, resources, recordings, because now there also is video. And then you can scroll down and see past precept classes. Also on the Brightway Zen website, under About Zen, Vows, and then Receiving the Precepts and Becoming a Buddhist, there's four recommended books. I mean, I don't, there might, that's about all the books I know on the precepts, but there's a lot of books actually on the precepts that we are talking about. So there's information on those four different books on the website. So if you want to do some reading, that's available. So the precepts date all the way back to the Buddha's time. So originally, there just became these guidelines for lay and monastics alike. Do not kill, do not steal, do not misuse sexuality, do not speak dishonestly, and do not abuse intoxicants. And those were the five, the precepts that lay practitioners kept. And then the monks ended up with a lot more precepts that governed the details of their everyday lives. But the moral precepts, we still have those five core precepts as part of our set. Our particular set of, we call them the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, and You can find the whole text of this on the website as well. They, the 16 of them, because the first three are the three refuges, refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which is kind of weird that they're called precepts, but there they are. They're counted as precepts. Then we have three pure precepts: cease from harm, release all self-attachment, do only good, take selfless action, do good for others, embrace all things and conditions. So my teachers used to say, like, yeah, you don't really need more than that. If you really just, you know, that just covers it. Those three pure precepts, just don't do harm, do good. But, you know, as human beings, it's more challenging than that. We need a little more detail. We need it broken down a little more. So that's when we have the 10 grave precepts. So those first five are the same, but we also have, do not dwell on past mistakes. Do not praise self or blame others. Do not be mean or stingy with dharma or wealth. Do not indulge anger. And do not defame the three treasures. Respect the Buddha, unfold the dharma, and nourish the sangha. And for each one of those, there's a positive phrasing of it as well. For instance, do not indulge anger, cultivate equanimity. So in our tradition, as I said, we do that annual precept study. And part of that is aimed at our Jukai ceremony, our precept ceremony, which happens once a year. And people who have been around for a while and they've studied the precepts, you know, taken that class or studied them on their own, and who want to, we call it, receive the precepts and formally become a Buddhist, can participate in that ceremony. And this is, I always think it's really interesting that in Zen, if you want to formally become a Zen Buddhist, there's nothing in there about promising to meditate. There's basically it's just follow the precepts. The other things are, you know, presumably you want to avail yourself of those tools that we offer in Zen. But at the very least, you need to just, you know, act ethically. And there's also an emphasis on the precepts in the sense that we say, as I'll discuss later, we see them, they're descriptions of the behavior of a Buddha. So if you are enlightened, this is how you would act. You would not kill or steal or lie or misuse sexuality or abuse intoxicants, okay? Therefore, if somebody's walking around claiming to be enlightened and they're acting unethically, if they're stealing or lying or abusing students or whatever, then you know they're not really enlightened. So, you know, it's kind of this litmus test in a way that, you know, sometimes there has been dangerous behavior from people who see themselves as being enlightened, as being some kind of, you know, hyper spiritual guru or something like that, and therefore the ethical rules don't apply to them. So in Zen we say that doesn't cut it. Your very behavior proves your lack of enlightenment. Also, I wouldn't say it's unique to the way that our lineage approaches the precepts, but very, very important is that we acknowledge we can't keep the precepts completely. We try, we do our best. We're only justified in breaking the precepts, or I should say we are justified in breaking the precepts out of compassion. So if you are motivated by compassion, then you might be called to break a precept. So a classic example of this is euthanasia of an animal. You know, you have an animal that is in great pain, and you kill it in a way that doesn't cause it great distress and pain, and, you know, relieve its suffering. And you may or may not agree with the ethics of that, but if somebody's doing that, they are motivated by compassion. However, we say that even if you are motivated by compassion, even if you do say to someone, oh yeah, oh, this food that you made me is just delicious, and you actually think it's terrible, and you're lying essentially out of compassion, right? You don't want this person's feelings to be hurt, but you don't escape the karmic repercussions of breaking a precept. The karmic repercussions may be different. You know, willfully murdering somebody is very different from accidentally, you know, bringing about somebody's death or euthanasia, but it's still killing. We don't escape from that, some kind of repercussions entirely. And I think, you know, again, to use that euthanasia example, you know, there is a sadness, there's a certain part of us that has to take a role, a detached role with respect to this life that we're taking, that isn't necessarily the most spiritually ideal relationship to take. Another aspect of the precepts is that we keep them around. Let's say these are vows that give shape and direction to our life, and they shouldn't be used to fuel self-criticism or shame. And also, with respect to the precepts and other things, but the precepts in particular, we do our own practice. This is about doing our own practice. Vowing to follow the precepts, using them in the ways that I'm going to describe, but they're not about looking around and calling other people to task about how they're not keeping the precepts. That's not how we use them. I'm not saying you're not going to notice, so-and-so is indulging anger, but that's not what they're for policing other people's behavior. So, the precepts as a field of Zen practice. Before I move on to that part of it, do you want to, any questions or comments about the precepts before we move on? For those of you who don't know, you can press the reactions button at the bottom and choose raise hand if you want to, and you can do that at any point throughout the class if you have some kind of question or comment. Kwa.
Yeah, hi. So regarding judging or assessing someone's degree of consciousness or enlightenment based on their actions, I'm new to the precepts, all this, I'm not familiar with all of it, but that is a sort of a debated topic in a lot of the, I'd say, harmonious teachings that come from other similar traditions to this. And I think maybe even, I don't know if it was Huang Po or Dogen or someone, but said that that you cannot know somebody's degree of enlightenment based on their actions. I just noted that that's come.
I didn't mean to say that, you know, that's that we're standing here trying to judge how enlightened is this teacher. Oh, she has so much equanimity, you know, like. So I think what I want to say more is, if you are breaking precepts and not feeling contrition about it, basically, if you're like, I can indulge anger, I can sleep with my students, I can steal, because I'm enlightened, then that's a load of BS.
Of course. Yeah. So
that's what I meant. Yeah, yeah. Not so much that like enlightened people look some particular way and they, you know, float above the ground and they're,
you know, because irritated. There's no way we can know. We can't know their experience. No. We can't know what's happening there. So anyway, I didn't mean to make too big of a thing of it. Kind of curious. Thank you.
Erica. Erica, do you want to go?
Yeah, sure. So it sounds like the precepts could maybe be compared a little bit to the commandments in Christianity. Mm-hmm. And I know with the commandments, it's like if you break them, you know, you have to ask God for forgiveness or, you know, a priest or something like that. But is it like with the precepts, you're basically just beholden to yourself if you break them?
Well, that is a wonderful question that leads me right on the next thing that I have written down here is no deity watching over and judging.
Got it.
So these are, I would say, some recommended rules to live by if you want certain things in your life. So it's a very pragmatic kind of thing. It's like, you know, you can do whatever you want, but the ancients, the masters, the people who, you know, contributed to Zen and meditation and all the tools that we have found useful say, you know, if you want to live a happy life and avoid suffering, you know, don't kill other people. You know, so like these are their age-old, well-tested recommendations. So I'm going to get into like why we follow them. But I do want to say, you know, as the precepts as a field of practice, it complements and is complemented by other fields of practice, which is going to be a running theme in this series, right? We've already kind of talked about, you know, Zazen and stillness can help us cultivate insight. In particular, the precepts I see complementing and being complemented by cultivating insight, and I'll get into that, they actually are tools for us to study the self and to study the Dharma. They're very tied up with opening the heart. Because the precepts, as you read, they're all about relationships with other beings and people. And then mindfulness as well, which I'm probably going to be generalizing the Nyoho category. Nyoho is a kind of mindfulness, which is close to my heart, but it probably need to have mindfulness in here somewhere. Definitely karma work. The precepts are great examples, a great way to study the self and see where we still get hung up and we're still attached to things. And then, of course, bodhisattva activity, because the more that we can act ethically, the more beneficial we can be to others. So recommended rules to live by if you, and there's three different things that I thought of as to why you would want to follow the precepts, why you'd want to adopt them, become a formal Buddhist and vow to keep them. And one is to relieve suffering and increase happiness for self and other. So this is that, you know, pragmatic recommendation, which I'll go into. And the second is if you want to create the ideal circumstances for your spiritual practice. So this is a motivation for the precepts that goes way back into original Buddhism, where the precepts, you know, if you imagine these practitioners trying to, you know, sit in deep in meditation and contemplate these deep dharmic subjects, and, you know, you're just not going to be able to do that if you're making a mess of your life. So this kind of behavior was recommended as a as a way to support your spiritual practice. And then finally, if you want to gain insight. So I will talk about how we use the precepts as tools for study, for cultivating insight. So just to backtrack a little bit then, and again, feel free to raise your hand or if you have any questions as I go. So, like I said, after long experience, the ancients observed behaviors that tend to cause conflict, stress, distress, karmic entanglements. So at the very basic level, these are just recommendations for leading a good life. And at this very basic level, sometimes even if you don't necessarily fully understand or relate to or see the importance of a particular precept, there's an aspect of like what I like to call fake it till you make it, where you just try to act like this as best you can. And it has an effect. It helps as a practical effect of just kind of cleaning up your life a little bit, simplifying your life a little bit. And then through experience, we become converted to each precept one at a time. Just for ourselves, we see, you know, no, breaking that precept causes suffering. Breaking that precept causes, you know, undermines intimacy. It undermines authenticity. It, you know, compromises my relationships. All of these things that end up motivating us to actually want to keep the precept. Not that it's always easy still, right? But at least we are inspired to do so. I guess I should say something that occurs to me as kind of a digression, but I guess I should say something when we're talking about trying to keep all these precepts. For anybody who's not familiar, there's questions that arise for people about the do not kill precept in particular, and the do not abuse intoxicants precept in particular. Because it's like, okay, so we're all vegetarian or vegan here, or are we like, we're all teetotalers here? So just to clarify, there are forms of Buddhism in China, for example, with that really like part of being part of that sect is to be vegetarian, hardcore. But that isn't the case with our lineage. We leave it up to people to find their way. And that's not saying that it doesn't matter. It's not saying, whatever you feel like. But we have to trust one another to look into our own hearts and ask ourselves, where are we going to draw that line? So, you know, just to live requires killing things. Plants are life too. Even organic farms. I have an organic farmer for a friend, and you know, you supplement the soil with blood and bone meal, which comes from somewhere. It's a, you know, in nature there would be things dying in that and going back to the soil. So, you know, if we're cooking together, if we're at a retreat or if we're at the Zendo, we do keep things vegetarian, but we don't require that people be that. And then in terms of alcohol, it's a similar kind of thing of, you know, really looking at what is the spirit of the precept, which is do not become intoxicated is what is called. So I don't read that myself as being never, you know, drink until you feel tipsy. There's all kinds of intoxicants, right? It's about trying to maintain a clear mind. So for the most part in your life, you are trying to maintain clarity and not fool yourself and not, you know, you know, go off after lots of distractions and intoxicants, then maybe it's compatible with your life to drink some. So again, we're not absolutist on either of those. Let's see, but let me go on here to the second part, second reason. So one was the, you know, to keep the precepts as just kind of this practical matter. And then creating the ideal circumstances for our spiritual practice. When I think about this, I think about that saying that the thief looks behind the door. If we are lying or cheating or, you know, talking about people nastily behind their back or, what, you know, indulging anger, there's going to be a lot of drama and stress in our lives. So even if you don't want to quit doing those things just for their own sake, they agitate the mind, they preoccupy us. If we are trying to sit zazen, or we are trying to cultivate insight, or let go of self-attachment, doing all of those things is going to really make it difficult to let go or be still or see things clearly. And it also, all the precepts have to do with self-attachment, which I'm going to get to in a second. So it, the more that we break the precepts without thinking or without careful mindfulness and consideration, the more we're reinforcing self-attachment, strong sense of self. And then for gaining insight. So see there being two ways that we use the precepts for study, for cultivating insight. So one is studying the self. So as I said before, we see the precepts as describing the behavior of a Buddha, an awakened being. I mean, awake to reality, awake to the reality of interdependence, emptiness. So when we break a precept, or we're sorely tempted to break a precept, it is a sign of self-attachment and the attachment to the narrative of the self, like myself is inherently real. So if you just look down the list of precepts, you know, do not kill. If you see yourself as interdependent with all beings, and you do not have this concept of yourself as just inherently existing and kind of against the world, then you would not. And if we think of killing in the sense here, not like I was talking about taking life in just in order to live, like with gratitude and consideration, but if you're killing in the terms of rejection, in terms of in the aggressive negative sense. So if we're killing, we wouldn't there's nothing, there's no one to kill. It's all, we're all part of everything. So it wouldn't, it's, we'd no more want to kill something than we would want to hurt part of our own body. Do not indulge anger is a great one. We have sayings in our longer text on the precept that elaborate on each precept a little bit. And do not indulge anger talks about not creating reality for the self. And if you think about when you're going down the route of anger and you're building your case, you're building, reviewing what happened, reviewing your arguments. You know, I for myself, I don't feel like there's any other time, except maybe like sexual infatuation, when you just like, you know, you're just, the self looms very large and feels very, very real. You have to maintain this narrative. You have to maintain your position. You have to, and that to let that go is, or to have a different relationship to it is can be very, very challenging. But if we don't have that sense of strong sense of self, we see self as empty. It's much easier to let that go. Not that it never arises, but we have a different relationship to it. But we don't, when I say that, you know, if you ever break a precept or you're tempted to, that's a sign of your self-attachment. But we shouldn't react to that sign with self-criticism or shame. If we're doing that, that's not really fruitful. So it's not like, oh, see, bad, you there you are with your, it's like the Buddhist just like, we're all self-attached. Self-attachment is just part of being human. So there it is. But we see it as a sign, and it's an opportunity to look at it, see it more carefully, see clearly what's going on. And one of my favorite authors about the precepts, Diane Rossetto, in one of those books that I mentioned that's on the website, I can't remember how she phrases it exactly, but it's something like when this urge to break a precept arises, it's like, you know, look here. It's like a little warning, like, hello, you know, ramp up your mindfulness, just pay attention to what's going on. And if we see how self-attachment arises and what happens when it arises, this is the power of mindfulness, of learning to pay attention or being willing to pay attention. And being paying attention long enough to see the karmic causes and conditions, to see what happens. What happens when you indulge anger? How do you feel afterwards? What happens around you? How do you feel the next day? Like, and if you manage to catch it and change your expression a little bit, how does that feel? How does that feel the next day? So it's a very gradual process of studying the self. Then I'm going to go into how the precepts are tools for studying emptiness, boundlessness of self, and interdependence. But let me stop where I am and see if there are any comments or questions. And any of you who have worked with the precepts for quite a while are welcome to chime in if anything's come to mind. I know sometimes we've got to just on Zoom, we have to let it wait a little longer. All right, Betty.
I was just thinking when you were talking about how situational the ability to follow the precepts is, at least for this is all so new to me, but how I can not indulge anger in certain situations where I have less emotional sort of investment in the relationship or whatever, and how it's much harder in other old, really well-established patterns. Anyway, so work in progress.
I think that's a great example. I'm just barely, you know, glossing over the intricacies of precept practice here, because it's what's cool about them is that they apply all day long. You know, so you meditate. How much do you meditate, right? Or how much do you do Dharma study or go to Sangha? The vast majority of your life is off doing other things. But the precepts apply in all the rest of the time. I mean, they apply all the time, right? But all the rest of the time, if they're about relationships. So if they are a background, you know, for our life, if we've been introduced to them and we're starting to just use them as a reference point, then we see all kinds of interesting things that come to the fore like that. Like, why in that situation and not that situation? What is that about? What do I care so much about in this situation that makes it so difficult to let go the way that I can do it over here, or yeah. Anyone else? Qua. You're still muted.
I'm glad they're called precepts and not commandments. I think precept, it's kind of a nice word. It's sort of, I think of it as, this is how good behavior looks.
Mm.
And so you sort of model yourself, you know, you can use that as a signpost or a pointer to a good life, as opposed to, this is a commandment and, you know, you're going to pay the price if you, you know, I mean, it just, yeah, that whole vibe, that, and that could be my own background and whatnot. But I, you know, being new to this, the precept said, yeah, okay, that's cool. I like it. You know, and the way you've described it and the way you've related to the relationship to them, it feels really good to me. And so thanks.
Yeah, it's, there's also the in the larger text about this, there are phrasings of the precepts that, you know, there's the very concrete part of, like, ultimately that first precept is about don't kill people. But we might expand that out, right? And we say don't kill animals. Maybe we, you know, expand that out and, you know, don't do anything that causes undue damage to living things. So there's different degrees, but we have sayings with each one about, like, phrasing them in a way that's absolutely impossible to keep. So the example that I can think of is the do not speak dishonestly. And I think it's Dogen that says, or no, it's the Bodhidharma precept, to put forth not one word is to keep this precept. And that's where you get at a profound, so what I was going to get to was, like, the more profound levels of this, where the precepts reflect emptiness and interdependence, and how we, like, words are inadequate to express the ultimate truth. So anytime we start to speak, it's not it. At the same time, we gotta talk. So it's like, because it demonstrates that whole spectrum, then it's a little bit more difficult to get all tied up in the details and, like, am I keeping this precept or not? You know, it's like, well, I'm doing my best. Gethel.
Just one of the comment continue about precepts not being commandments. You know, I perceive them as being more, I mean, they are tied into the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and which, you know, the basis of Buddhism. I mean, they are part of the path we're choosing to go on. Mm. And they're like a roadmap. Mm. They're like a map. They're not orders for us to do. I mean, we are choosing this path. We're choosing to try and gain some semblance of enlightenment in this lifetime, mm, if not full enlightenment. And so the precepts are really, you know, to me, they're kind of that little thing that sits back here, and sometimes they ring a bell and go, is this behavior really fitting in with how you want to live your life? Mm. Are you really justifying this anger? No, I'm really just sort of indulging that, and it's making me feel bad. Well, stop it, because
yeah,
that's not your goal.
I like that. Yeah, checking in with our own aspiration. I think as soon as we perceive, like, the precepts and or any aspect of the path as being something that we have to do, or other people are expecting us to do, or we do if we were good, like, we want to choose this. So just a little bit here at the end then, with the precepts as tools for studying emptiness, boundlessness, essentially you, to one extent, so another way that we break down our practice is to think of it in terms of samadhi power and karma relationship. So samadhi power is, you know, in our meditation, through our dharma study, we're seeking to be able to experience a more non-dual relationship to things. What allows the insight to arise. Our mental map of the world can fall away for a moment, and we see another aspect of existence that is very, very important to see because it changes us so much. So the precepts, you know, in karma relationships, that's samadhi power, and karma relationship is, you know, trying not to kill and trying not to steal and trying to be nice to people, trying to be compassionate. So it's like, and working with those obstructions that we have, which I'll be talking about in the karma work field. If you have habits that cause harm to yourself and others, Zen practice is an opportunity to look at those habits and get to know those habits and perhaps untangle some of them. So you might think the precepts are more on that karma relationship side, help us, you know, wrestle with the self and self-attachment and work on our habits and all that, which they definitely are. But there's an aspect of them that also complements the samadhi power aspect of our experience. So in a way, if you think about this, if the precepts describe enlightened behavior, we can learn something about enlightenment by acting this way. So as I was saying earlier, that if we were enlightened, if we didn't have this sense of delusion about the self, we wouldn't even be inspired to kill or steal or abuse intoxicants, because we'd be in touch with that sense of interdependent co-arising, where we are not separate from anything. Even though we are stuck in this skin bag for this lifetime, this being, this skin bag, is only here because of an infinite number of other causes and conditions. Other human beings, air, gravity, the position of the earth with relationship to the sun, and at an even more profound level, I am not who I am without all of you. If any one of you disappears, I am different. And this is the kind of this is the way of seeing reality that we can open up to in a very personal way. We can actually perceive things like this. Maybe just briefly, but even just briefly is very transformative. So because of that, you know, to cause harm to anyone else causes harm to us. So I think then we might be thinking of this also as like those positive side of the precepts, which I didn't read, exploring that. So cultivating and encouraging life, honoring the gift not yet given. So, you know, do not steal, honor the gift not yet given. What does that mean? So we steal out of a sense of lack, out of a sense of fear and lack. So if we explore, what is it like, what does it mean to when the ancients say we have everything we need, we lack for nothing. So on the kind of the relative scale of things, maybe we do lack for things. In what sense do we not lack for anything? So the precepts inspire us, they challenge us to look more deeply like that. My classic example of working with this is, which some of you will heard me tell this story before, but I got really, really angry. I'm probably carry a lot of anger around with me generally, but I don't kind of consciously, you know, stir up like I'm angry at this person. So this is one of those rare times I was angry at this person. I thought they did something terrible and I was just completely outraged. I just couldn't believe that they did this thing. And I was so upset, and I had to be with a group. I had to be sitting with a group and talking to them afterwards. So I'm like, I don't know how I'm even going to do that. I am just so angry. So I decided to go for a walk and then come back. And it's like, even that was like, in a way, was a step toward not indulging anger, because rather than just sitting and stewing, I was like, okay, I think a walk will calm me down, right? So that's a first step. And then as I walked, I just kind of, you know, looked at all of this with mindfulness and thought, okay, you know, this, whatever this person did, they've been doing for a while. The earth hasn't ended. So it's not like an absolute emergency, right? That I correct this thing and I point out this wrong. Okay. And I felt that rage starting to dissipate. Not that I didn't think any differently. I still thought, what, you know, this person did something wrong and I was going to call them to task about it at some point, but that rage dissipated. And it was so weird to feel it dissipate that way. Like, I was like, this is so real. This is the self right now. This is me. And to feel that, to let go of that was like, honestly, it was like letting go of self. It was an example of seeing how self is not what we think. It's not as real as we think. It's just kind of comes and goes. It's some, now it's anger, now it's boredom, now it's this. It's just kind of this flow. So I feel like I really gained some insight into the emptiness of self through that precept practice. So that's my example. Much more could be said, but we only have a couple of minutes. Any last questions? I mean, I know I threw a lot threw a lot at you there. Has to be like at least one more question before we go.
I was just looking back at my notes here, and you talked about how we are not separate from others, and harm others is to harm the self. And you also said, I am not real without everybody else, without all others. Could you expand on that a little bit more?
Well, I guess it's always difficult to put this stuff into words, right? But in that moment when you can sit without your, you know, not so attached to your mental map, just this moment, and there really is no, so then the self is, boundless, you know, like a different way of perceiving it. Emptiness and boundlessness, the same thing, but a different way to approach it. And if it's boundless, then all things are the self. Like, it's all one seamless reality is what it feels like. So then, you know, every little thing is part of that. And it's not like the loss of any one thing means, you know, then the whole is destroyed or anything, but everything contributes, including me, including little old me, is just as significant as anything else. So not easy to describe.
Everything else matters, I guess, right?
Huh?
Everything else matters.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess it's also like, when we do go to define ourselves, when we step outside of that, you know, the independent dimension, and we're even back in the dependent dimension, even then, I'm short because you're tall. I'm a woman because you're a man. I'm an American because, you know, I live in this place and you live in that place. Like, it's all defined by each other. And, you know, who I am is made up of all the people that I interact with and have learned from, who support me. So that's another way to look at it. we came to, it's after 9, so I'm going to close, but Betty, if you have a question, I can stick around.
I'll wait until next time.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. I will close with my verse then. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you for being here, everyone.
Thank you, Domio.
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.